Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to True Crimes Podcast. Today is Monday, July 13th, 2015, and today I have a very interesting guest, Dr. Andrew G. Hodges. Dr. Hodges is a practicing psychotherapist and nationally recognized forensic profiler who has developed a method of profiling and examining forensic documents and oral communications. This method is known as thoughtprint decoding. This discovery reveals that the unconscious mind possesses a brilliant superintelligence vastly superior to your conscious mind's ability to observe and communicate. Dr. Hodges has been involved in many cases, including O.J. Simpson, where he presented at Quantico at an FBI conference, JonBenet Ramsey, where he's writing two books and an 80-page profile for Boulder authorities, Natalie Holloway, he wrote a book, and was on the search boat looking for her body, and he knows where it is. He's also created a profile for serial killer BTK, and he worked on a Casey Anthony profile, and now Amanda Knox. All of his work is from spontaneous writings of the suspect, where they must confess through thought prints. Dr. Hodges has published 8 books, including The Deeper Intelligence, Into the Deep, The Hidden Confession of Natalie Holloway's Killer, A Mother Gone Bad, The Hidden Confession of JonBenet's Killer, and his latest book, which we will discuss today, As Done Unto You, The Secret Confession of Amanda Knox. All of his books are available for purchase on Amazon.com. Hello, Dr. Hodges.
Hello, Liz. Good to be with you.
Yes, thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast. Maybe you could start by telling everyone a little bit about your background and how you became a profiler.
Sure. It was, Liz, I participated in a breakthrough to the unconscious mind, which some people are probably familiar with from the book Blink that Malcolm Gladwell wrote on the ability of the unconscious mind. Our work was ahead of him, but I worked with the man, started out a huge breakthrough to the unconscious, and we saw that it was far more capable than we knew, and how it quick read situations, perceived situations, then told you about it. And so in therapy, a quick example is you'd work with somebody and they'd come in and they would say, well, thank you very much, you've helped me. But if they were picking up, they had more work to do, they would keep talking about, they would read themselves and tell you if they were finished or not. If they were finished, they would talk about completed projects. But if they were not finished, they would present what I call thought prints, repeat symbolic messages. In language, this is always on two levels. It's literal and it's symbolic. So you have to take every word both ways, particularly dealing with therapy, in therapy or criminals. So they would read themselves, I'm not through, and they would pattern messages of unfinished business. And you would have to see it to believe it, but they would say, they had to tell themselves they weren't through. So they would talk about, you know, a tile man came to our house to redo the bathroom and he isn't finished. And they would tell another story about their son wanting to quit the football team. And we told him, no, he's got to complete the season. And the father may be converting the garage into a playroom and he wasn't finished. Or a daughter wanted to drop out of school and they said, she's not finished. So they would pattern these symbolic messages, repeat messages of unfinished business. And so you start to see how they're reading themselves. And I saw they had to tell the truth to be free. And so long story short, I met some people in law enforcement, and I was telling them about the work in therapy and how the mind, the deeper mind, told the truth, how bright it was. And it's probably 1,000 times brighter than our conscious mind, as Malcolm Gladwell and Blink really made the case for. And I was talking to some people in law enforcement, and they said, well, why don't you use that in profiling? And I said, well, what's that? So I read a book by John Douglas, The Mind Hunter, which at the time I greatly respected, still do. I think we're way past that in profiling. But anyway, I got into profiling, and my first case was the O.J. case. I was studying it for another reason, a self-sabotage syndrome, and And I started looking at it, and I saw how he confessed in his had several documents that he wrote a suicide note, and his first interview with the police were 13 hours after the crime was recorded, and he'd written a book from jail and so forth. So I had all his mind there, and so one thing led to another, and in every case that you mentioned, I had something from the mind of the suspect or the killer. And they all confessed between the lines. I let them tell me. So what I saw was they had to confess. So they knew deep down they have this inbuilt deep down moral compass. And that's what, you know, it's like a Lady Macbeth moral compass. Once you kill or do something very criminal, you've got to confess. And they'll confess only between the lines. They'll try to cover it up. So that's what I do. And I depend on them to tell me the story. They're reading themselves. So I enter every case, and I've certainly seen people that are innocent and believe they're innocent, but I go in every case neutral, and they tell me through their through this idea of the way they read themselves, and they tell me in their thought prints if they did it or not and why, and they give you the whole story, and you learn. I mean, this is, we have to understand the unconscious mind is a truly super intelligence, and it can tell you vastly more than you can ever figure out on your own, and vastly more than their conscious mind can tell you or my conscious mind can keep up with. And so I really try to, you know, keep up with their unconscious and their super intelligence. So that's where we are.
Okay.
And I use that in profiling.
Now, and when you receive a document, what kind of document are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for anything. I've done some private work, some public work, but I mean, like in OJ's case, he had a recorded police interview, he had a suicide note, he had a recorded Bronco chase. There's more in there than you know. He wrote a book from jail. So I look at anything from his mind. And my next case was the Ramsey case, which had the ransom note. And so in the first case, I had a suspect, and I profiled to see if he did it. He confessed to it and told an amazing story of why he did it, OJ. My next case was the Ramsey case, and I let the ransom note. I had a killer. I mean, whoever wrote the ransom note participated in the crime, so I had the killer, but I didn't know who it was. Would it lead me to the murder? And it did. And you know, so I always work from something verbatim from the mind of the suspect. So in the Holloway case, there was a 5-page email 4 days after the crime. I had some interviews from people that were on the ground that night and police interviews. So I worked from that in that case, and they clearly told us the body was out in the ocean and what happened. And, you know, in my opinion, in decoding it, and then, you know, went from there to BTK and started communicating with the police, and he was still writing the police and so forth. So I worked in documents there. Casey Anthony wrote 200 letters in jail, and now Amanda Knox here is a prolific writer. So they all, and she wrote a 5-page email less than 2 days after the crime, and she wrote numerous other things, spontaneous writing. So what you see is a pattern. Criminals must confess. If you think Shakespeare understood this, and you know, you think of Lady Macbeth, and so they have to confess, and they have to clean, they don't know it, they have to clean their conscience. And there is no such thing, I want to be very clear about this, I understand the behavior of the worst people, like BTK, the serial killer, brutal killer. He looks like he's a sociopath. He's not, deep down. Deep down, everybody has this moral compass that must confess, has what I, you know, like a Lady Macbeth compass. So that's what I depend on, are documents. And I trust their mind, and they're going to tell me a lot more than I can ever speculate on. And so I just let them tell me, and that's how I work, from their mind.
Great, great. And now in your book, As Done Unto You, about the Meta Kircher murder case, it was fascinating. You not only looked at Amanda Knox's email, but you built it up going back into her background, her early life,
right.
As well as the other two, Raphael Schlechto and Rudy Guede.
Right.
And you talked about all their shared emotional baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And you studied pictures as well,
right.
A few pictures of Amanda Knox.
Right. Right.
That was very interesting, right? Very thorough. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you know what I did, and I should say in my other cases, like I've worked from emails, I've worked from police interviews recorded, you know, verbatim. I've worked occasionally from interviews from other eyewitnesses, but I've never, you know, I work from other, I use other things, but people have, I've worked from journals. The O.J. case was a suicide note and a book that he wrote in jail and so forth, and Amanda Knox, a book she wrote. So I work from all different kind of documents and journals and emails and letters, helpful letters. I was involved in a case where the killer, which is very, you know, this is where the FBI is helpful. They'll talk about how a killer will often try to befriend the family and appear at funerals and things. So I've worked from letters to the family, all of these things. Everything is what we call grist for the mill. People have to communicate. So, and you mentioned in this case pictures. I just used the pictures. There were three pictures of Amanda that I used to decode symbolically, like an art expert would look at a picture in a museum, and you start to say, okay, why, what's the body language? What are they trying to tell you? And the last picture was one of Amanda. She went into a museum in Austria on a trip, right on her way to Perugia, and she's in this military museum, and she drops down in front of an old Gatling gun and starts mimicking firing away. And she's telling you that she's got a tremendous amount of aggression and repressed anger. And this, by the way, was in her mother's hometown. And her trauma comes out of her relationship with her parents. That's her fundamental trauma. She had some super major traumas. But so I use the pictures just to teach the reader, and it gives them a picture. I would never say the picture's going to tell me the whole story. It's just going to tell me what's on her mind. Why did she select a gun? Why did she drop down to it? Why did she start envisioning a scene firing away? Why was it in her mother's hometown? And why did she write on the back, Nazi? Who was the Nazi? I think she became a Nazi after she was treated like a Nazi victim. And it's very, you know, this criminal work is very tough. And what you also see, the superintelligence doesn't fool around. It just gives you the most basic, powerful imagery to say, this is what happened to me, and this is what I did. And, you know, criminal work is brutal. It's not for the faint of heart, but it's the same thing in therapy. Somebody to get to a major trauma, they will paint horrific stories, and you've got to be able to hang in there. So it's not an easy thing to deal with this trauma. We don't want to look, you know, as a natural reaction, and Amanda, you know, the whole thing, the way they defended her was she was such a nice person. But if you look below the surface, you could start to see signs she really wasn't all that nice at times, and she showed signs of regression immediately prior to this trip to Italy. She was only in Perugia 6 weeks with her roommate before she killed her. Now, she was ready to explode, and she tried to tell her family this before she left. And she, for example, she threw a party. She got arrested for throwing this, had a charge. She had to go to court. This was a misdemeanor charge, wasn't arrested, but she was charged. She had to go to the court because of a wild party she threw with rocks being thrown and a really out-of-control party in a wild college part of town in University of Washington right prior to the trip. I think she was trying to signal her parents, don't let me go, I'm out of control. And she staged a burglary with her roommates in April before she left in 2007 and thought it was a lark, but she was trying to tell them, I'm out of control. And they took her to Italy, and her family over there in Europe got her a job, and she didn't show for it. She was out of control and just let everybody down. So when she got to Perugia, where the crime took place, she was only with her roommate 6 weeks and before she erupted. And so she was announcing she was on the verge of exploding. So that's how I work. And she wrote this email within 48 hours of the crime. And typical of criminals, they must tell you this. And so it was the freshest thing that she did spontaneously was this email less than 48 hours after the crime, and it's the whole story. It's a five-page email, and that's what I looked at for the first story. She wrote other writings, spontaneous writings, and they all match. So,
now, what thought prints from her email stand out to you?
Well, if you go through it, you know, I'm looking at it's a five-page email, and you know, that's it took me a long time, and I detail this in the book, in one sense. Too many details, but it was necessary to make the case. And I'm a forensic profiler, and I want to make the scientific case. This is a science, by the way, but I we documented that in an 80-page report on the Ramsey case. Here I'm writing to the lay readers, to the lay public, to the public, but I also want to make the scientific case. So So this deeper mind is so brilliant, it tells you exactly how it works. This is how it starts out. What it will do is it will, you read every word in this email as a part of her or part of this crime, and she's going to tell you if she did it or not. And so the first thing is, the opening line is, this is an email for everyone. I'd like to get it out and not have to repeat myself 100 times. Well, she's telling you, I'm going to get it out. I'm confessing for the whole world to see. And you read through her denial. Key denials are very important. And so when she has to tell you the truth, she'll often resort to, I didn't do this, I didn't do that. And so here she says, and I don't want to repeat myself 100 times. She's going to repeat her thought prints more than 100 times in this document. And so, and then she says, I'm going to do this like I've been having to do with the police station. Understand, she is the police. She's got this inner policeman that must tell the truth. And her bottom line truth is she's going to tell you, this is what was done to me, and this is why I'm murdered. And so she goes on, just images of, I can't say what I'm about to say, I can't say to journalists or newspapers. Now, journalists and newspapers are symbolic messages of this letter. She's the journalist in this letter, she's the newspaper, and she's telling you. And she then makes a slip, and I require that. She wants whoever to listen to keep it secret. And she says, I require that of N1, A-N-W-O-N-E, instead of anyone. And one killer. One killer. It's really A-N, separate the word one. There's one leader in this crime. And she gives you a lot of these what I call message markers. There's information here. And then she makes in the end of the first paragraph, This is what I saw in the Ramsey case. I wrote the book, Who Will Speak for John Bonet? That came out of the opening lines of the ransom note where they talked about, we represent a small foreign faction in the Ramsey case. We are speaking as a lawyer, as an inner truth-telling lawyer. We're going to tell you the story in the John Bonet Ramsey case. So I read like that, and I just thought, okay, she's going to tell me something. So this is what Amanda did. She says, this is M account. Now, understand her slip. This is M account of how I found my roommate murdered the morning of Friday, November 2nd. She immediately, in the very first paragraph, gets into the word murdered. So she's telling you a very vicious image. And she says, this is M account. Well, M is, it's not only my account. She meant to say my, but she put M account. I read that immediately. Why the slip? Crucial slip. And the unconscious makes these brilliant slips. This is Meredith's account. She's speaking this for her victim. And this is what she's killed her. And she's trying to tell you now, I'm speaking for her. Now, if the letter unfolds, and she says of how I found my roommate murdered this morning of Friday, November 2nd. Read it another way. Read it just a little bit more. This is Meredith's account. I'm speaking for Meredith of how I found my, or of how, just skip the word, I found my roommate murdered. Skip the word I, drop found, I, my roommate murdered. This is Meredith's account of how I, my roommate murdered the morning of Friday, November 2nd. Now, that's my hypothesis. But she's speaking for a victim. I see this over and over. Goes back to Shakespeare and Lady Macbeth. And so then you have, it will unfold how she's speaking for a victim, and she goes through and gives us her what happened. And she goes through and gives us her motives and so forth. And she does that, and I can tell you where she goes from there. But let me stop there if you want to
yes,
ask me.
Yes, it's so in depth.
It is in depth. This is where she goes. Let me just tell you where she goes from there. Immediately, she goes to images of her roommate being asleep. I think asleep, death. And she makes numerous slips, and she says, she was fumbling around, Amanda now is fumbling around in the kitchen. Remember, a kitchen knife is crucial in this thing, because that's what Amanda stabbed her with. There were four stab wounds, two major ones, two to three major. The ones on the right side of the neck where Rafael Solicito was, who carried around like switchblades, but the brutal stab was on the left side of the neck facing her. So it was on the left side of her neck. So Amanda's on one side and Raphael's on the other. Now I'm jumping ahead, but when she stabbed her, it was a vicious, vicious stab with a kitchen knife. And, I mean, that unfolds later, but that's what she's trying to tell you, that she was fumbling around with a kitchen weapon, And then where does she go next? She says, well, then Meredith, this is the last time, quote, she saw Meredith. Now, understand, the last time she saw Meredith was when she truly saw blood on her chin after she had stabbed her. I mean, that's when she died. So where does she go? She says, the last time I saw her was she emerged from her room, just say she was in her room, with the blood of a vampire from the night, you know, it was Halloween, which was very symbolic. It was the night of the vampires in Perugia, the biggest party night of the year, the biggest night of the year in Perugia. And it says she emerged with the blood of a vampire dripping down her chin. That's where the injury was. It was a huge. That's where the stab wound was. It got the, you know, that's where it got the right thyroid artery. Now, from the left side, she comes in and comes all the way across, cuts the right thyroid artery, and that was the one that bled profusely. But she's already gone there. And so I'm thinking, okay, my hypothesis is being validated, but I got to hear it more. And she goes through and through the letter and repeatedly gives you images of, repeatedly talks about blood and things like that. So, and gives you images of, she'll go down here and talk about, well, when I pierce my ears, now you just read that, she's piercing flesh. I mean, here's Amanda, and there's blood all around. And, you know, and then she goes through other images that are very key, like what was her trauma, and she takes you back to her major trauma in this letter. Now, you know, we've only touched on, Liz, about probably 3% of this email. I mean, this is just the opening paragraph, but she is announcing what she's going to tell you. So it's very detailed work, and they use markers in here like I can't say, okay, you read through the denial, I can say, and then she gives you another marker, journalist, newspaper, information, account. All of these are communication references that I start to see the unconscious mind is going to validate its messages by saying, okay, here, I'm going to give you communication references. And we started to, you know, call these message markers. So it's what it does, the unconscious mind, the superintelligence says, look, I'm going to first tell you that I'm communicating in a very special way. I'm then going to give you images of murder. I'm going to give you images of vampire. And then I'm going to validate it with more images of what I just validated with more images of pay attention to this communication. So that's how it does it. And it validates its work, and then it repeats itself. And if you remember, her opening line said, I don't want to say this 100 times. Read through the denial. She's going to tell you over and over this same pattern. And she's going to give you the same thing, message markers saying this is important, and then she's going to give you the violent images, and then she's going to say, now pay attention. And, you know, she closes her email with telling the authorities, go back and basically read this document. And she's going to make reference to forensic documents that were left in the house, and she's going to talk about the forensic document in this email. If you understand it, this is a forensic document. They never understood this. This letter went to court. They didn't have anybody that knew how to decode it. This is very new work. It's just the cutting edge of the mind. You know, the FBI took us so far in profiling, and now we're coming in as the experts in communication. They're not trained. They're not therapists. All my work came out of being a therapist, and that's where I learned it. Over 35 years, and they have none of that. They've never done one therapy hour. They don't know a superintelligence exists. So that's what I'm basing this on, and, you know.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, so we only have about 5 minutes left. I know we could talk for a long time.
Yeah. Right.
but now about, so far, her saying repeating this over and over again, that is exactly what's happened in the media and with so many people, including FBI profilers who have written books about this case, like John Douglas.
Correct. Right, exactly.
You said you don't necessarily agree with that?
Well, Douglas unconsciously will tell you the exact opposite. I mean, I'm looking at his works now. He wrote two books on the case where he alluded to this case. One was about the case, The Forgotten Killer. He says Gertie is the way I believe it's pronounced. Rudy Gertie did it, a single killer, and Douglas talks about people who get target fixation, and he talks about how the Italian authorities lived in fantasy land. Let me cut to the chase. Douglas is confessing that he had target fixation. he knew too much about this case coming into it. He didn't come into it neutral, and he knew about this criminal, Rudy Gurdet, and it was a he read it as a slam dunk. He got target fixation, and he talked about how police can get target fixation and get overly invested in their abilities. I think he was overly invested in being right. Now what he does is to go back. And he reads crime scenes from a distance. He may go over it. He may look at the films. But he's trying to decode it. And he gives you all the meaning, like what this means of the break-in in the room. And this was not staging. He missed the whole thing that this was staging. He didn't think like a policeman it was so obvious. Everything looked to on the surface. I can see how he thought of this was a staged burglary. Like Rudy Gurdet was left his fingerprints there and all of that, and he blamed it on that single killer. He didn't think like a cop. He didn't think like it's too obvious. Look deeper, and there were a lot of contradictions with the crime scene and what he reported. But the deal was that he should have. There was much more evidence, and he should have thought it's too obvious. Look deeper, and he tried to tell himself that. But so it's a new method. But I did want to end on this. I mean, Amanda takes you through this letter, and she gives you what she did, and she gives you repeated vampire images. She'll make a slip like I talked to the poli, P-O-L-I-E, and she meant to say police. But she's trying to tell you, I'm consciously lying to the police, look at my lies, and so forth, and she'll keep referring to lies. But then she took you to images of which I went through, and which matches her history, your earlier question. She takes you to images of her core trauma. And her Amanda had a, which is what we see in killers often, they've been very abused, and then they become abusers. It's like bullies become or they're bullied, and then they become bullies because they feel very helpless, and then they must take out their pain on others. I'm convinced BTK did that. I could show it that. I could show you that. And that has never been reported on. I will report on that one day. I think I know what his core abuse was. But Amanda had a major abuse that people are missing. And, her major abuse had to do with her parental circumstances and a casual affair, and they waited 5 months to get married, I'm convinced, and she gives you in this letter numerous images of near abortion, and a near abortion in her mind, and I've worked with victims of that. Remember, now she lived, and so she's got this thought deep in her mind that I cannot believe my parents almost took my life. And her father and mother, quickly divorced. Father leaves mother for another woman, and down the street within a year of Amanda's birth, and so she has all this other abandonment. But Amanda, in her own way, there were other immediate motives. There are always two motives. There are immediate trigger motives, and there were several trigger motives. I think there's one primary one that stood out that last night. But she had a time bomb motive, and she was waiting to go off, and I think she repeated what was done to her. And that's where the title came from, as Done Unto You. She was doing to her victim what was nearly done to her, and trauma victims, these near traumas get frozen in their mind like a war veteran, their war experience where they're nearly killed gets frozen in their mind. And in her mind, this trauma was frozen, and I think this kitchen knife, horrific stab wound on the left side of her neck, unlike the other three, two different knives, which Douglas missed, and this vicious stab wound, I think she was recreating what happened in her mind with the near abortion, that she envisioned herself as that happening to her. And in one sense, when a trauma happens that's so close to dying, you believe it happened, and that's what soldiers come back and tell me. I was as good as dead, and I could tell you that from other trauma victims. So once you have a near-death trauma, it becomes frozen in your mind, and that's, it's a very deep level of the psyche. That's the level I work at, and so that's kind of the Knox story, that just the thumbnail sketch.
Yes, and that's really just the tip of the iceberg, right? There's so much more in your book, As Done Unto You, which is available on Amazon.com. Dr. Hodges, thank you for being on True Crimes Podcast.
Thank you, Liz.
Okay, have a good day. Bye.